Hello and welcome to the Legendarium Green Team. I'm your host, Stormrunner, and I'm joined today by Kiptan, Hiran Fan, and Ashaman. Today we will be discussing all of The Farthest Shore by Ursula K. Le Guin, book 3 of the Earthsea cycle, which was published in 1972. We'll start with a non-spoiler section, and then we will give a spoiler warning before heading into spoiler territory. So what did folks think of the book?
I like this book. This is one of my favorite books. Despite me, like, this being my second read-through of it, it's just something that I feel the need to just kind of sit with. The last time I had finished this, I'd never gone on to Tehanu, which is the fourth book in the series, because this just feels like kind of like a perfect capstone to what Le Guin was trying to do with Earthsea. And while I certainly intend to get to Tehanu at some point, it's just this is a perfect meditation, I think, on death and life and, you know, reality and fear and beauty and all of that. And I think it has a special place in fantasy for that. It's very spiritual, and I think is capable of deeply moving people, so long as you're receptive to the style that it has, which is fairly unusual for fantasy.
I thought it was a lot better than the DARE program that I had to go through as a kid. What, Hiran?
I was telling Ash to put it to a number.
3.5.
Ah, good, good. Excellent.
Yeah. Only the highest praise from me.
Yeah, I'll give it 9 drugs out of 10.
What kind of drugs?
There's only one drug.
Psilocybin.
Psilocybin? Oh, nice. Yeah.
Hazia.
See, this book.
Hazia. It's hazy. Let's see. Yeah, I think this book is excellent. I think just like the last two. It's more similar to the first than the second, I think. And that it's more of a traditional quest fantasy. But yeah, characters are great. I think it's always thematically resonant and moving and deep, which is what you expect from Ursula K. Le Guin. The whole thing's really about life and death and meaning and finding meaning in life and death, and it's very Taoist in that, and I think it's an excellent. If people who read books for themes would love this, and people who read it for adventure would love this, and people who read it for dragons would love this. If I had to say if I liked it more, I think I liked it more than this first, but not the second.
I think that if you read the first two, you've got a pretty good idea where this one's going. It's a nice standard journey. With a young boy and an old master, and really, what do you need more than that to be a classic fantasy? Like,
yeah. There was no romance, though.
Oh no, yeah, no romance in my fantasy books. I lament endlessly about that. Yeah, but you know what? I lament more bad romance, and this didn't have that either.
Yes. Yeah, I thought it was excellent. Maybe in the running for my favorite book I've read this year, certainly probably top 3-ish. Yeah, it was really good. I feel like this is the, at least for me, like I finally feel that the promise of Le Guin as a writer, like this was now fully fulfilled to me with this book. Because I've read her stuff before and I've always liked it, and she's a classic that, and she's like is a master, but at a more intellectual level. But this is the book that kind of really everything clicked in terms of just the bare bones of the story, as well as what everyone has said so far about the themes. And I really liked how she used protagonists and brought back from previous books and how that was used.
Also, one thing I like about Le Guin is that her side quests that her books take on are never in the, like, final parts of the book. They're always in like the first quarter to third, maybe first half. And then we get on with the action. We then finally have like a clear path to where we're going. And yeah, we might be able to predict it in advance. I certainly predicted large portions of this book, but when her endings come along, they're not hampered or impeded by endless fluff or string tying to try and make a cohesive end. They just end where the story would naturally end. It's fine.
But also, a lot of the side quests are resolved pretty much as soon as they're introduced.
Yes.
We're in like the next chapter or two.
And I love how it's thematic in this world. Like every island is kind of its own thing and they don't really interact all that much.
Yes. That lets her. God.
Yeah. The troubles of one island rarely impact another, which I like.
Yeah. Although there is a consistent. At least the deeper issues that the islands are facing.
Yes, yes. When something imperils all of Earthsea, all the islands are imperiled.
I think that Earthsea might have the setting that is the most neatly tied into the themes of the story out of like any fantasy series ever in, maybe. The small islands on a vast, unknowable ocean, absolutely perfect for what she's trying to go for, right?
Yeah.
I like the way she had the Navi.
I might argue if Realm of the Elderlings is more, but you know, I haven't finished that series, so who knows? I haven't finished this one, so I'm interested to fully know each and judge them.
I forgot to mention this, but listeners will understand. I'll just say the same thing I said with the last book. Her prose styling is the same as always, and it's fantastic. And again, if you like good writing, then you'll enjoy this.
She yep. makes me actually like the travel scenes, which is rare for me when I'm reading books. But like, I enjoy imagining the characters on their boat doing their Wind Waker thing, and it's epic and gorgeous. And yeah, I'm very here for that.
Like when, so I've been reading Fellowship of the Ring alongside this, Lady Ash. And yeah, I think Le Guin does travel much better than Tolkien does. not that I
hate Tolkien. Shorter.
It's definitely shorter.
Don't worry, Robert Jordan would soon come along to try and bust both of them.
Try.
It certainly takes longer, but yeah.
Yeah, I deeply appreciate how Le Guin, like one of the first fantasy authors, really willing to dive deep into Eastern philosophies and sort of reinterpret them for Western audiences. I think this is the book that she does that the best.
And that reminds me, you could really see Le Guin's influence on Philip Chase.
Oh, yes, author of The Way of Dan and the Edain trilogy.
I do think that this is the book where her like central theme has been at the most at the forefront. Mm-hmm. No escaping it.
Pretty much from page like one.
It's certainly more obvious.
Yep.
Which I think is to good effect. I think that's why the book works, is because pretty much each island is tying. Everywhere they go ties pretty directly back to that theme.
Did you guys like the larger peek at the Faculty of Roke?
Oh, yeah, it was neat.
It was fun.
It was a really good description.
Yeah. It's not a lot, but it's there. It's fun. It gives them a little bit of flavor, character. I continue to like the Master Doorkeeper.
Everyone likes the Doorkeeper, right?
Everyone likes the Doorkeeper.
So that's the thing I like about her world building is she hints at a lot beneath the surface that we never see. But it makes the world feel a lot more lived in and real. I don't know. I think there's a lot more authors. I think they're coming back to that again, but I think there's a lot more authors should do that instead of just hinting at something and then going into it completely. and leaving no questions.
For me, the world of Earthsea doesn't feel so much real as like surreal. It feels ephemeral in a lot of ways, which I think does the story credit. It doesn't feel like a strongly physical world. It feels much more idealistic in the philosophical sense of maybe the world is just something that exists in our minds rather than something that ties back to like atoms and matter and whatnot.
So you're saying Link's Awakening was inspired by Earthsea?
I haven't played that game, but sure.
I'm saying that the fabric of this world has an almost liquid quality.
Hmm.
Oh.
How about that?
Yeah, it certainly is dreamlike, which I think aids... I think that really makes a lot of the more emotional beats more poignant, and I think that... Yeah, that definitely... makes a lot of the smaller moments hit harder.
Also, it's very much a time where, like, people couldn't go to the bottom of the ocean. We didn't know it was down there. It was the abyss. It was endless and unknowable.
Still kind of is.
I mean, it's still mostly unknown, but we still can't. We, like, if we pick a spot, we can be like, what's there? Okay. We got the cameras there.
Yes, what's in this very tiny, small location?
Yep.
Yeah, very dark.
Anything else before we go into spoiler territory?
No.
All right.
How each of these books is complete. I really like how each of these books is independently complete.
Yes. I think that's something that, in general, a lot of modern fantasy authors could take notes from, but
yes.
Yep.
Even as someone who doesn't love episodic stuff as much as serialized things, there is something to be said for this is a complete unit of something, and I have a satisfying beginning, middle, and end.
Very much. Okay. Ready for spoiler talk.
All right. So spoilers for the entire book in 3, 2, 1. Okay, shall we start with I'll do a summary.
Sure, sounds good.
Okay. All right, so there's an evil power that is slowly eating away at the fabric of the Earthsea world. Magic is losing its power, and various people and creatures are going mad and turning to their baser instincts. Arran, the young prince of Enlad, seeks help from the Archmage Ged and the Masters of Roke to fix this crisis. Ged and Arran embark on a journey across Earthsea, investigating various places where magic has been notably disappearing or where there have been other strange occurrences, in hopes of finding the cause of this decay. The various former mages that Arran and Ged encounter have all had visions of or been visited by the dark wizard Cobb, who is seducing them into death by convincing them to give themselves to Oblivion, where he has convinced them that they will have immortality and no longer need to fear death. After an epic journey to many of these islands, including the Children of the Sea's very cool raft town and Dragon's Run, Ged and Arran go to Death, the Land of Death, to confront Cobb. There, Ged sacrifices his magic to save Earthsea, and he and Arran defeat Cobb. Arran is then crowned king of all the isles, and Ged sails off into the sunset.
Was anyone kind of surprised at how conservative the book was?
In what sense?
Oh, in terms of like divine right of kings and whatnot?
Yeah.
Oh.
I was a little weirded out by that. But there were three wives. Country,
this entire area has all of these problems that only the real king can solve. And the real king needs to be an honorable monarch. And everything is hunky-dory.
And he must be the descendant of the ancient king.
And that's another thing. Yeah, he needs to be the right one. And
it was a bit odd, although it didn't really matter in terms of the... how the actual story played out, but it was a little bit surprising from Le Guin. It mattered because Ged like thought it did. Is that what you're?
Ged thought it did. One of the dragons was kind of like deferential to him slightly, or Ornn Ember.
Yeah, that's true.
I think if it didn't matter, that it wouldn't have been brought up so much and been an important part of the story.
That's yeah. true. Maybe I was just glazing over it whenever it came and, up. But.
And many times because he remembered the songs of his kingly lineage, it brought back some of the magic to the world.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
That's just surprising. I'm not going to say it bothered me because... I mean, I've read those kind of stories before, but just it seemed kind of out of character for Le Guin.
Yeah, I really liked that all of the islands were their own thing and not beholden to a single king.
I mean, this was begun in Tombs of Atuan with the Ring of Erech Akbe.
Yep, Erech Akbe.
Yeah, so... this like kind of building on like, oh, these lands are disunified. There needs to be some kind of divine order set above it all. And the king seems to be part of this. But
there's been like no progress made on it for however long Ged has been back from the Tombs of Atuan, which has been a while, right?
I think that...
Yeah, he had like a series of adventures that they talked about, but...
Like, it's been at least 20 years.
Yeah.
That's probably gets to my only, if I had to say, issue with the book would be it feels like we get the beginning of Ged's, like, journey with Wizard of Earthsea, and this is the end. But Tombs of Atuan, like, book two is not really the middle of his journey. So there are parts where I would have liked to have had a more of a middle for Ged. I don't think it needed it, but like it did, there was a little bit, it felt like there was a little bit missing at parts. Again,
we got to see him as student, mage, and archmage. Or if you want, child, man, and crone.
Crone?
I mean, that's true. It doesn't really bother me that much, but like, and maybe I just would have wanted to see like a little more of him in Tombs of Atuan if that were the case. But it works. It was yeah. a thought.
So, Kip made a joke. Do you think he ever went from virgin to virgin to virgin?
Huh?
Well, the three forms are virgin, maiden, crone, right? So,
maiden, mother, crone. Yeah.
Maiden, mother, crone. Yeah.
I mean, it's sometimes referred to as the virgin, right?
Sometimes, yep.
So, is Ged just virgin, virgin, virgin?
I don't know if we have enough info for that, but I don't think
so. Yeah. I
would say that Ged could fit easily into the three faces of Adam, the male counterpart to the three faces of Eve. Yeah.
Ash, for our listeners, would you like to explain?
Ah, yes. Let me look up the formal names. So
it was just a joke.
No. You can't make these jokes, Kieran. You're not allowed. So at least as far as TV Tropes goes, of course, the most reputable storytelling source on the internet, the three faces of Adam are the Hunter, the Lord, and the Prophet. So the Hunter, corresponding obviously to Wizard of Earthsea, where generally associated with being the youngest of the three faces, going out and hunting to find himself, to find his place in the world, to prove himself. There is the Lord, as TV Tropes says, the man who struggles to maintain stability against the ebb and flow of the world. In the place of naivete, there is now knowledge of the world, both of its dangers and of its wonders. He has an established place in the world and a reputation to maintain, and possesses the skills and resources to keep them. He must strive to achieve a balance between fulfilling further goals without risking his losing what he already has, or becoming too obsessed with what he possesses to progress forward. And then, the Prophet. The man who looks back upon his life, usually the oldest of the three. His knowledge and experience have grown into wisdom, and he seeks to impress that wisdom on younger generations. has either fulfilled or given up on his aspirations. If he does have any goals, they will either be fulfilled through a proxy or be a gift to the younger generation.
Oh, hey.
His fears center on... Yeah?
Oh, sorry. I was just saying, that sounds familiar.
That sounds familiar. His fears center on what will happen after he's gone, both to his legacy and to the world itself. Yep. So, the trilogy here fits kind of very neatly into those three archetypes.
Okay.
I doubt it. Like, Gwyn probably didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, she's famously aware of common structures. Sorry, famously unaware? I meant to make that a joke.
She likes ignoring them a lot, which I'm a fan of.
Or subverting them. Yeah.
Yes.
I did like that, on staying on this theme a little bit, that it was... We don't have to go down this particular rabbit hole, but... It's almost like a version of Luke Skywalker that people thought that we might be getting in the sequel trilogy, or a version of where we could just say a different version of the Luke Skywalker character. I'm using Star Wars because that's probably very commonly would be very commonly known, but I enjoyed placing that into the story a little bit.
Interesting.
I really enjoy, yeah, like the contrast between Ged and Wizard of Earthsea and Ged here. You really get the sense that he has gained a deep wisdom from his activities. And also I appreciate his kind of wistful longing for the life of Ogion.
Mm-hmm.
And the implication at the end that he might have finally earned that for himself. He's finally atoned for his great mistake in Wizard of Earthsea, calling the shadow and causing the death of that
Nimmerly
contemporary Archmage. Yeah.
I really like the beginning of the book when we're given an allusion to a lot of Ged's exploits that we didn't actually get to see in the previous books, and I wish that we actually got those because they sounded awesome.
They do sound awesome, but they also sound typical.
Yeah, but parts of the series are a little bit typical. Like,
it, oh, for it's, sure. Like,
but this book ends with the rightful king coming back to his throne.
Like, yeah. No, it,
we got it's a fun journey through death, which and the mountains of pain.
Yeah. Mm.
The descriptions were so good.
Yes.
Did anyone else notice the various allusions to spiders?
No. So. Did you notice the various allusions to the River Styx? Because that was obvious.
Well, like, spiders are mentioned several times in the story. Spider webs are used to describe the setting often, especially when in a creepy, eerie setting. And Cobb is the name of the bad guy. And Cobb is an old word for a spider.
Oh.
I did not like that, because spiders are awesome. And be nice to spiders. But otherwise, it's a great use of a language.
Okay. I like the Silkworm Island and how they don't discriminate against the bats, because if humans can profit off of the moths, and so can bats.
The bats. It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like the Na'vi Island of Rafs.
That was very cool, too.
Earthsea way of water.
Yep.
Or the Children of the Sea.
The
Pacific Lodge Town from Pokemon Gen 3 for anyone
water,
that get that.
Water World?
Yeah.
All these great highbrow references.
Yeah, the raft people, the Children of the Sea. Probably my favorite part of the book aside from the end. You know, you just get to see this completely different style of life. And having them appear in the story and then showing how even they are falling prey to Cobb's machinations. Their life is also being leached out by the hole in the world. That lends a seriousness to the content. Like, even the sea is kind of dying here.
Do you think that Ged and Aaron brought the sickness with them to the Children of the Sea, or was it just purely coincidental that they happened to be there at the time when the chanter lost his voice?
Yes.
I think it was more coincidental, because it seemed like it was already... Like, there was no place that they went to where this wasn't happening. It still seemed more coincidence than anything else. Like, even these people were not untouchable.
I just meant both answers.
Sorry?
I just meant both answers. It could be coincidental, or it could be, you know... Honestly, I think they actually probably brought it, because it's the farthest away from everything else. Everything else is already succumbing to these evils, I suppose. And it only shows up after, you know, Aaron and Ged show up.
But what about the dragons? Because when we meet the dragons, they're like, by some measures, I guess, further away. And they've already kind of mostly fallen.
Yeah. They're not. Further away from what, though?
So, okay. Center.
Because they're very close to the actual door.
This is true. But I guess I would say that they're also the ones that are closest to the primordial nature of the world, and seem to, like, if anybody would last the longest, I would expect it to be them, because they're the ones most deeply rooted in the magic of the world.
Sounds familiar.
I think that's like specifically targeted, though. By
that's
our
why
man
I think
Cobb.
That Ged and Aaron brought it, because the further away from the center you get, it seems that the magic is spreading inward, right? Or the infection, or whatever you want to call it. And so even though
it seemed to be coming from a western direction.
Okay, I just misunderstood.
Yeah, it wasn't affecting anything to the east.
But it was also, like the west and the south, right?
Yeah, west and
that's
south.
Where Aaron came from originally. Yeah.
Well, it did eventually reach Rook.
It did, yes. But there's still many islands to the east of that.
No, that's true.
And... The children of the sea are way out even further west. So by distance, I think they're actually not necessarily maybe that far. But by connection to the rest of humanity, I think they're perhaps one of the farthest groups out there.
Their metaphysical connection is definitely the most tenuous.
Yeah. But then they got two new visitors, and then all of a sudden, no more songs. So. I think there was some degree of contamination of civilization on them.
Probably all those disgusting pigs that the people on the islands live by, and spreading sickness. Yeah.
And did they not have any mages?
I don't think so. In the raft, in the children of the sea. I don't think so. Although I would probably argue that they kind of. The people that were singing were functionally mages, as far as the world is concerned.
That's interesting.
Well, because they lose their song, so if the whole thing is that magic is dying, then they're losing their form of it.
But singers and craftsmen were generally losing their abilities as well. Like the deep wells of creativity and love for
any
life
maker
drained out of the world.
That's true. That it wasn't just mages.
Yeah. It was whole populations that got affected. It was just the learned people first.
Yes, because they're the ones most sensitive to it.
Yes.
It seems. Yeah.
They hear the voice inside their head. People with desires.
I like how Ged says at one point, like, he's the only one that has actually managed to hold on to his magic, his abilities, because he does it for nothing but the art itself. He doesn't have desires, right? Like, he's like a fully actualized being, essentially. Just living perfectly in concert with the universe. As the Archmage seems to be charged with, right? But I don't even know really what it would mean to lose the ability to do magic in a world like this. What constitutes magic in Earthsea is also like really hard to put your finger on, right?
I don't think you could turn into a dragon anymore.
Yeah. But apparently also you can't tell the right dye color.
Yeah. Yeah, like you're no longer able to dye silk.
Admittedly, that's a hard thing to do.
Maybe it's Le Guin saying that dyeing silk and highly skilled jobs are actually just a little bit of magic.
And magic seems to be fundamentally tied to life here, right?
Yeah, that's a big. Yep. That's a big theme, and
yeah. So something I'm kind of left wondering is, like, if Ged gave up his magic, what is the actual difference between that and dying? Like, where does the line get drawn? And
well,
why do some people in Earthsea have just like a fundamental ability to do magic and others don't?
I don't think the second one really has an
answer. It doesn't have an answer, I don't think.
Yeah, but well, as far as the story and themes are concerned, it's kind of the same as far as Ged losing his magic, but
I know what I'd say. I'd say that losing your magic means that you no longer have a responsibility to maintain the balance, but just to live subject to it.
He gets to move from his life of doing to a life of being.
Being?
Yes.
I love that quote. I wrote that speech.
Did you notice that the it was called the Hill of Being when they went into the land of the dead?
Yeah, that was an interesting name.
They go down the Hill of Being and descend further into darkness until at the bottom there is the dry river.
Hmm. The description of the underworld was fantastic. It's constantly going down, no matter what direction you go.
And also that it's the idea of death is not this like malevolent force that's like casting people down with fires or explosions, but just this like quiet oblivion where people are just there and have lost all hope and like just choose that numbness instead of like facing reality.
It was darker than the other two.
I think it was darker because this underworld is objectively a terrible place to live, but then Ged reveals at the end that the shades there, the shadows there, are just that. They're only shadows. They're not actual people. They are things that have the shape and appearance and mannerisms and perhaps even speech of people.
But
they're not them. They're just the shadows that they left in the imprint upon the world. And eventually they will disappear because their real stuff was recycled back into the living world, the physical world of Earthsea itself.
That's true. I still think the description and how it's done is almost more heartbreaking than the first two, just because of
mother and child dying at the same time and their echo being left over, or the references to a child sacrificed at an altar but nothing coming of it, or the city of just druggies not living because they've lost all desire to do anything else.
Yep.
Yeah, and the impending sense throughout the entire book of like Ged is journeying to his functional death.
Yeah, I like that the bad guy Cobb was the opposite of Ged, or at least like what Ged would have become if he didn't absorb the shadow in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all into his sense of self. And his sense of self, he separated from the rest of the world, and that's where the real evil came from. There's no balance there, and it's just a gigantic ego that's sucking in everyone else. Capitalism, maybe. Greed.
Capitalism.
Yeah.
Yes. I like how Le Guin makes the point, the very Taoist and Buddhist point, that you don't exist separate from the things that surround you. So if he's giving these things up, he's really giving up himself, and he's left with like nothing, essentially, but his own fear and insecurity.
Speaking of people being left with nothing, did anyone else think that like the middle of this book was going to be Aaron trapped on a slave ship? Because no. I was like, oh, he's gotten separated from his mentor and he's gotten enslaved and now he's going to have to go through hardship. Maybe I've been reading too much Hob, but I was like, oh, suffering builds character.
I mean, yes, clearly, like, Gwyn thinks that suffering builds character here, right? Because it, like, multiple times throughout the book, is like, ah, yes, he's stronger now. He's a lot better.
there's lots of suffering, and there's lots of self-doubt, and there's a lot of self-doubt, and a lot of bad things happen, and he gets upset, and yes, that's all in the book, but they don't dwell on it like Robin Hobb does, let's say.
No, it's over in, like, a couple pages.
Yeah, I was expecting it to last like at least a chapter or two, but then
how do you feel about Ged's decision to not free the slaves or not punish the slavers?
He freed the slavers.
He didn't punish the slavers. The one guy couldn't.
Oh, he let the slaves do it. He let the enslaved people do it.
I mean, I like his. I like my one quote from this is actually deals with his explanation to Arun about it. Do you see, Arun, how an act is not, as young men think, like a rock that one picks up and throws, and it hits or misses, and that's the end of it. When that rock is lifted, the earth is lighter, the hand that bears it heavier. When it is thrown, the circuits of the stars respond, and where it strikes or falls, the universe is changed. On every act, the balance of the whole depends. The winds and seas, the powers of water and earth and light, all that these do, and all that the beasts and green things do is well done and rightly done. All these act within the equilibrium. From the hurricane and the great whale sounding to the fall of a dry leaf and the gnat's flight, all they do is done within the balance of the whole. But we, in so far as we have power over the world and over one another, we must learn to do what the leaf and the whale and the wind do of their own nature. We must learn to keep the balance. Having intelligence, we must not act in ignorance. Having choice, we must not act without responsibility. Who am I, though I have the power to do it, to punish and reward, playing with men's destinies?
Yeah, I love how Ged says, I don't punish before punishing.
Or after. Punish. He the only thing he did was free the slave, let them do what they wanted, and he made one guy mute until he had something good to say, which is a good punishment.
He has something worthy to say, yeah.
Something worthy to say. And then he goes on about this, but like literally he's mentoring the king who has to give out punishment later in Italy after the book's finished, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I would say that he...
Which to me says by virtue of having power to punish, then like you need to have the responsibility to punish.
I would say that Ged accepts that it's not his place, but it's perhaps...
Everyone's place.
To do it. Well, I don't know. Like for a deeper discussion of this topic, we need to like discuss the lathe of heaven, right?
No, we don't. That's not like, today.
That's what that book is about. But from like the Taoist perspective, like yeah, when you act in a way to change the world, that's a dangerous thing to be doing, and so he wants to really minimize the changing of the world that he does because. He doesn't like the magic on Earth. Like if you change, like the power to change things. If you don't have a deep understanding of what you're doing, you're going to cause horrible things to happen. Like happens in Wizard of Earthsea, right? So the strength to not do something is something that Ged has to learn.
That goes to the speech about a life of being and not a life of doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because Ged in Wizard of Earthsea was very much living a life of doing.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised to see Ged urge haste as one of his guiding principles at the end? When something must be done, you must first think of haste.
Yeah, I mean that was a special circumstance, right? Because like, oh, the world is coming undone.
I mean, islands were burning.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. But the urgency was such that now we just urgency increasing, I guess. Like now it's the whole world and not, I don't know, the scope became more cosmic, at least in Ged's mind.
So I know this is off topic, but does anyone get Avatar vibes from this?
No.
Okay.
I see what you're saying, but
yeah,
there's neutral Jing, right?
Sure.
No. Oh, the Last Airbender.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about the Way of Water, although that was also true.
Yeah, you were earlier talking about that before.
we don't need to talk about the James Cameron.
Yeah, too good, and we talk about them too long.
Last Airbender also obviously inspired by Eastern philosophy, right? So yeah.
And it's definitely a story about one young boy being guided to assume leadership over all of humanity.
Mm-hmm. And balance.
And balance, yes. Balance.
Yep.
Are there any sequels that ruin the original?
For Avatar or Earthsea?
I meant Earthsea. I get it. Okay, so the Ghibli adaptation is The Legend of Korra to the...
All right. No, I'm not going to bite on that. But
somebody's going to cut it out in the editing.
Oh, no, it's staying in.
Controversy breeds discussion.
Yes.
I challenge our listeners to guess when I've been joking and when I've been earnest in this discussion. Might not be as easy as you think.
I challenge our listeners to find the series whose central theme is undone the most by the end of the series.
Oh.
Wait, is that a jab at something?
I mean, it's a Korra joke, but...
Oh.
I think it's Star Wars, probably.
Well, so I don't fundamentally disagree with both of those, depending on when you're... depending on when we're ending it. For Star Wars in particular.
That was also vaguely inspired by Eastern philosophy. Well, but then kind of,
I think it's Aragon, actually.
As it's gone on.
Yeah, my call is Aragon.
Aragon, okay. Wait, interesting.
I haven't read Aragon.
I wouldn't put Aragon here for that. Like, in the sense that... That's a digression. I don't think that Aragon's ending fundamentally disagrees with the rest of it. Because the beginning was written by a 16-year-old, and he didn't have a coherent idea at the start.
What do you mean? Star Wars is a very coherent idea.
Star Wars is coherent because it's just the hero's journey, literally copied, like, beat for beat.
I'm hero of a dozen faces, yes.
Yeah.
Hey, you're leaving out Akira Kurosawa.
Hmm?
I mean, Star Wars was very directly inspired by the Hidden Fortress by Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah, I mean, also Flash Gordon, right?
Yeah, Flash Gordon's the big one. I haven't seen it, but yeah, that's the big one. Anyways.
Anyways, Farther Shore.
Earthsea, yeah. One thing I noticed that I did like as a detail was that the book refers to Ged as Sparrowhawk for almost the entirety until, I believe, it's...
Until they hit the Dragonlands.
Yeah, basically I would have to pinpoint the moment, but I think it's when Ged's name gets revealed to Arryn.
Yeah, are we given Arryn's perspective through, like, the entire book? He wouldn't know it otherwise.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Well, yep. The perspective is, yeah, loose. Yes.
I mean, it's a third person.
There is a section where it's the Masters of Rogue. For a bit.
Right.
And I like those sections.
Yeah, they're really good. I love the Master Patterner.
Yeah, he's fun.
There's a Taoist hero right there.
Oh, the Grove scene's was very cool. We actually go there.
I like the descriptions.
The Master Changer. And how they have their own little quartz crystal that reveals the truth.
What I was reading. Do you highlight sections and be like, oh, there's a metaphor here? Because I started reading this.
Oh, there's
like,
Lord of the Rings here.
I started reading this 2 days ago, and I'm rushing to like finish this before thing. And if I see something, I'm like, oh, this sounds like a metaphor. I highlight it and I intend to go back and read it later.
It's just the entire book.
I'm talking about specific descriptions, right? And I intended to go back and think about it, and I ran out of time because I finished this like half an hour before recording.
I don't bother trying to highlight metaphors. I only try and highlight turns of phrase that I think really capture a moment.
And that's also admirable.
But speaking of specific metaphors, what do you think the sea cave that said either beginning or end in the old tongue, depending on if you were young or old?
It's a mirror.
I think that section could have been cut, personally, but it's a nice little vignette, but not even a vignette. It's just...
The great thing about Le Guin is that even if you find sections that you think can be cut, like, you'd only be cutting like a paragraph or two.
It's true. It's
going
true.
Back to the travel sections and why I don't mind them.
Yeah.
It's just an omen. And you know, Wheel of Time had much more annoying ones. It's fine.
Oh boy. That's a...
I think Le Guin, more than most other fantasy authors, so obviously she plays with metaphor made real that fantasy likes to play with. I think that almost all the value that you can get out of this for Le Guin is just to like kind of soak it in and try not to break it down in an analytical sense, which is definitely my inclination for reading things a lot of the time. But like she is conveying a worldview and a philosophy very well and very coherently, but not in the same way that a philosopher would, like in a rigorous sense. It's, you know, using the power of storytelling to, you know, communicate through very, very feelings-centric view of the world, right? Which is something I really appreciate. I think it's a rare art among authors these days, especially fantasy authors.
I will also say that she is an author who appreciates thick fog, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
It is much more prevalent in her books than it is in my real life, and I wish I could change that.
Move to England, right?
Even England doesn't have the kind of fog that she's talking about, which That's is true. Like you can't see more than 10 feet away from your face.
Sometimes those fogs come to Ottawa.
I do not get them nearly enough.
Yeah.
I want to live in a cloud sometimes. And apparently Gaunt does all the time.
Where I live, we're basically under a constant fog advisory, and then the fog actually never comes. I don't get it. I'm not kidding. It's frustrating. I like fog too. I wake up in the morning, where's the fog?
It's a cool aesthetic. I do agree with the feelings part about Le Guin. She had me at least tearing up less than three pages in, and then several various points throughout the book. And yeah, it's more, and it is more of a testament to her skill as a writer, because it's less about like specific things that are happening and more about how like the phrasing she's using, how she's painted the picture of a scene, like a maybe like a really specific interaction between characters that's kind of symbolizes something like bigger in terms of like the course of someone's life. And that's like a pretty, yeah, that's a pretty, not unique, but that's something she in particular does well.
Mm-hmm.
How did you like her writing of the delusions of madmen?
Good.
Ash, that was quite the smile there.
Yeah. I mean, shout out to how she writes the general feelings of malaise in the world. Like, it very much feels like Cobb has granted the world a serious case of clinical depression. The madmen, they're the perfect blend of hard to understand and like you can understand what they're coming from. And like, how their fear of death has warped their perception of reality, has caused them to become undone and to lose themselves in a way that Ged never does, because Ged has embraced all that he is, and that includes the fact that he's going to die.
Okay. I was talking more about their like repeated words and phrases and just the way that she wrote their dialogue.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay. I like your themes though.
I think No, I think it's effective. In particular in the Hort Town, when they're that former mage, and then the Silk Island. Yep. Those two in particular stand out as being pretty effective. What and the Silk Spinner mage person when they're on the boat, like that was a it was an effective interpretation of that, I thought.
Yeah, I liked how Aaron was unable to really decipher anything meaningful in their speech, and Ged was like, we must listen, and we may not believe them, but there is still information to be had here.
Detective Ged.
Yep, Detective Ged. And then eventually, you know, our little young prince learned that, and maybe in the future he will listen better.
Were you guys convinced by Le Guin's arguments about death in this book?
No.
Yeah. I mean, that's already what I thought, so it's like I needed to be convinced.
For a while, I was like, I don't understand how you're making these arguments when you have a literal world of the dead that we're in. But then I learned that they're not actually the dead, really. They're just shadows. Which, I mean, we only have Ged's word on.
So maybe I suppose my answer is no, because I didn't need convincing.
Convinced of what in particular?
That we need to die, and that death gives life meaning, and vice versa. Yeah. And that when you die, you become part of the whole, and then we're all one, and all that crap.
And things like grasping after eternal life cause you to lose yourself, and you know, render you unhappy and unable to live the good life, let's say.
Yeah, that part I'm totally sold on. The kind of metaphysical part, not really, but the seeking to not die was very, I mean, because like then that consumes you, and yeah, you lose who you are. That go ahead, Aaron.
If you want to replace that with any other unhealthy obsession, sure.
Yeah.
Do I think it's noble to try to extend your life, or extend humanity's life, or maybe even have a goal to reach for? I think that's great. Specifically trying to not die, I'm not sure.
It's not even that.
I think it really falls apart in life extension arguments.
I wouldn't say that Le Guin is arguing against things like life extension in the series, because like obviously like in A Wizard of Earthsea, Ged tries really hard to save a girl who's dying of plague, right?
Yep.
It's about accepting that one day somehow you are going to die and you cannot stop this, you know, however long it may be in the future. So the desire to become an unending thing is a fundamentally corrupting thing for you to do.
Sure.
Or at the root of your being. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I'm on that. But she made a lot of arguments, and the crazy people in her book, which I do not take for her arguments, made a lot of arguments about the wizards not extending life 1 hour. And I was like, come on. Like, this must be a really depressing magical field on the world to make them forget all of the wizard healing.
Yep, you're not reading correctly if you're not attributing character ideas to the author and then blaming the author for that.
That's true.
I'm sorry. I'll improve.
I thought it was very troubling when Le Guin advocated for a child sacrifice in this book.
How dare she? And slavery too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really thought that her stance on land management was abysmal because she advocated for burning it all to the ground, which is an outdated strategy.
It was very bold of her to create a world of the death, which to me says that we should be in the world of death. It's on the page.
Yeah.
You can't refute this.
I think that she overlooked the easy option, which is when you open a door into death, the counterbalancing action is clearly to open a door into life. And so we have to go find, we have to go to the positive realm and make a countervailing hole in the world.
I think that when Ged closed the doors to death, what should have happened was like a window just kind of opens off screen.
I also couldn't help having his Dark Materials flashbacks throughout this whole book.
I need to read that series at some point.
Yeah, it's
specifically the third book, and those who know know.
Oh, I think I know. Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot of mind searching if you're familiar with the third book. Actually, the whole thing is about opening gates into different worlds, right?
Portal Fantasy.
Book one? Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Oh, is this book a Portal Fantasy?
The Farthest Shore or Historic Materials?
The Farthest Shore. They go through multiple doors. One of them a metaphysical one.
You know, I'm going to channel Red for a moment and say that when they were with the Children of the Sea, that was a portal.
As soon as Arin enters the Roke, he's gone through a portal.
Yes. The Master Doorkeeper.
Yeah.
Taking the question as not a joke, no.
Yeah, I also disagree. This is not a portal fantasy. Yeah,
this is not a portal fantasy.
Just because someone goes to the underworld, which is a different world, does not make it a portal fantasy. Unless, like, it's a really, you know, maybe half the story takes there, and it's about the journey between the two. And
Is it grimdark?
Yes. That one's a definite. Yeah.
No.
There's a lot of grim stuff that happens. And yeah, there's a lot of physical darkness.
I mean, the book ended on, like, a really bleak note. And it turned out that Ged was actually the bad guy the whole time. So
he stopped them all from living forever.
I mean, this is a story about how, you know, despite all of our best attempts, we're still going to go back to a monarchy. You know?
I didn't fully correlate all of the negative things in the world happening with the rune of ending appearing in the sky. But did anyone else have a closer look on that?
I didn't quite catch how that.
Because it was when the Rune of Ending fully appeared in the sky above the festival on Midsummer's Eve that the chanter lost his voice. When the last star peaked over the horizon.
Must have missed that.
My silence means no silent, no comment.
There were definitely references to it earlier in the book that I didn't catch. And I was wondering if they correlated to specific events. And next reread, I will check it out.
I thought it was kind of interesting how much references there were to the ending of the world in this book. Especially since, like, in the Earthsea seems to have a very cyclical way to it. Is the end of the world ever something that's actually going to happen, or is it just a kind of metaphysical idea that they use to think about, you know, life and death and nations rising and falling and whatnot?
Does it matter?
For this, I would lean more along the metaphysical side of that, where we don't see, other than some of the dragon stuff, we don't see mass amounts of physical destruction. Like, it's just...
Is there a difference? Just, I'm going to give a Steve answer.
Probably not, but, like, functionally it doesn't matter, but to humor to humor the question, I'd go along with the metaphysical angle.
I would also lean towards metaphysical answer with Le Guin, because the whole world of Earthsea seems like a dream sometimes.
Right? Like, maybe this is a dream in the protagonist's mind of The Lathe of Heaven, you know? After or before the book, he dreams of Earthsea.
When Ged rode out to the place where the water turned into not water anymore, he never came back, and it's all been a dream.
And you can, like, this is a world where you can seemingly sail to the edge of reality. Like,
yeah, though in which direction remains to be seen.
Yeah. Is Earthsea even a sphere? It doesn't quite seem like it.
I think it's, as far as we can tell, it's unbounded on one side, maybe, but bounded on the other. I don't understand it.
It's like Narnia rules of life.
Do the whales create reality wherever they go?
Oh, maybe.
That's the link to Link's Awakening.
Yeah. Are dragons and whales the only things that can go beyond the borders of the sea?
Besides wizards, right?
Well, I'm actually going to Google it because that sounds...
I mean, we saw Ged get to a border and kind of have to stop.
Maybe he could have gone on and he just decided not to.
Maybe.
That's like, I'm really hungry, I can't.
Maybe that's another of the unwritten books.
Well, we have some question if we want listener question if we want to do that.
I think we basically answered it.
Yeah. Okay, I'll still ask it for the sake. What is the thematic significance of Ged losing his magic? That one, I think we did kind of answer, but
yeah,
it's death.
Moving Ged from dies. Doing to being.
Yeah. yeah, and then does Arryn redeem himself by the end of the book?
So I don't think Arryn ever does anything that he needs to be redeemed from.
I agree.
Yeah.
But in his head, he does. And I think in his head, he has forgiven himself for his childish misconceptions of what was expected of him.
Well put.
Yeah, I think the defining moment in his arc is when he decides, before him and Ged enter the Land of the Dead, that, okay, he's going to trust Ged, and he's going to trust himself. And Ged's like, ah, yes, you're a man now.
Yep. And you will be king. And this is definitely a secret and not at all open and blatant.
And, yeah. He's finally able to draw his sword. What do we think about the Freudian implications of that?
He had his last gasp of childhood with the Children of the Sea, and then he put his childishness aside and went to save the world.
Okay, is this a children's book?
Sure.
Okay.
Why not?
I'm not saying children can't enjoy it, or that adults can't enjoy it, obviously.
There's slightly too many names for it to be a real children's book, but...
Well, I think this is something I'd be comfortable giving to, like, a preteen or a teen, like, early teenager.
Yeah, it's...
I'd be fine reading it to my children.
There's some kind of, like, more existential themes than in, say, book one or even book two.
Yeah, I don't think it's anything that a child can't.
Definitely they couldn't, but yeah.
I mean, the through line of these three books is that they're all books of becoming, right? Like Ged, Tanar, and now Arryn. All need to find their own place in the world, and all of their places in the world end up being quite distinct, right? Different paths you can go down.
I really want to know what Tanar's place in the world ended up being, because at the very start, they just like name drop her as the White Lady of Gaunt or something like that. And so she gets a title, but we never get any explanation of what that title implies or...
I think she's living a life of being.
I do too. Yeah. But Maybe a little bit.
That's what at the end of.
Yeah, we'll never find out, apparently.
Gaunt doesn't need meddlesome people, but I think maybe occasionally she meddles.
Yeah, maybe.
She is the protagonist of Tejano, I believe.
I asked that question because we kind of talked about it, but the fact that Arryn is going to be the king is not something any adult reader would miss.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if children would also like catch it, because it's almost a secret that's not a secret, right?
I mean, if you ask an 8-year-old, I bet they'd know. So,
I mean, like in this sense, it's kind of just like a Disney movie, right?
Exactly.
This is the the line.
We have a young prince. He's gonna become a king. It's what happens.
He's stepped in his place. Okay, his he's place in the world and king, set
but
the world
not
right.
The king. I think it's different, right?
Huh?
Yeah, king of all the
islands. In this world, though, because his dad's a prince. His dad is not a king.
Oh.
I think that the various islands are just going to be like, oh, the Archmage of Roke crowned a king? I guess he's our king now.
He's got the dragons behind him. What are we going to do?
He's got the ring. What can we do?
But really, what does that mean for the political landscape of Earthsea, and does that matter for the Children of the Sea?
I think it is going to possibly prevent another thing like this from occurring. Like, I think there's some sort of magical binding on the world which ensures that only a king can open a door into death like this. Or if there is a king, then a door into death will immediately be discovered. I don't know, something. I think there's an actual protective effect on the world from having a king.
That seems to be the implication.
I want a colonial story. It takes place 20 years after this, where Arryn needs to suppress the people.
The far off West Islanders.
Him. Yeah, and the people of the sea.
Yeah.
How do you colonize them? I guess. Just steal their rafts.
Colonize isn't right. Maybe just kill them all because they're
imperialized.
Savages.
Yeah, you take over the Long Dune.
Oh yeah.
The world of Earthsea seems to have very limited real estate.
I'm surprised there aren't more people living on the sea.
Yeah,
Gaunt seems big and empty.
It seems like this world is a world of few people to me.
Yes.
I agree.
Yes. Yeah. And too many of them live in the 90 islands.
Hey, that's one of the the coolest settings in the whole.
Okay.
Oh.
No, Gaunt is the best.
Goat
fan.
What?
Kip's the goat fan.
Yeah. Reminds me of Maine. Oh.
Fair.
I say we wrap up.
I think we're good.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, this concludes our discussion on The Farthest Shore by Ursula K. Le Guin. Join us on the Legendarium Discord server, the self-styled friendliest place on the internet, for more discussion. Again, I'm Stormrunner with Kip Tan, Huron Fan, and Ashramon. Thanks to the Legendarium Podcast, Horizon Brave, and to Jingle Punks for the intro and outro music. And thanks for listening.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.